Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Dr. Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Hello, Mr. Tom Slater. I'm doing fine. Happy New Year to you and Happy New Year, listeners.
And especially Happy New Year to our guest today, Tom Harwood from GB News, a presenter, co-host of Good Afternoon Britain, and as we've just been learning, a public transport nerd and enthusiast. So,
well, we were just talking about how I went on a joyride on the Lizzie line, the Elizabeth line, when it first opened. I'm amazed that Christopher Snowden has not yet been on it. I'm shocked, actually, and appalled. But I hope that Tom, my name also being Tom, won't be a bit of an issue in this conversation. I maybe we can have a system of some kind.
I'll just keep saying yes, Tom, and thanks, Tom, and good point, Tom. And it makes me feel like Dominic Sembrook in the West
End. This is, yeah, I mean, in many ways, reminiscent of The Rest Is History.
I like to think so. And I think our listeners do too. We've got plenty to talk about today. We're going to start off, Chris, with a theory of yours or a view of yours that people might find a bit counterintuitive. Things can often feel a bit bleak out there at the moment, what with the economic outlook, talk of blackouts and so on. But you want to talk today about how maybe the latter half of the 2020s is actually, you know, things are looking up. They might actually be quite good. We might have that roaring 2020s that some people talked about in the wake of Brexit finally going through and a new optimism dawning. Do you want to tell us a bit about why you think that's the case? Because I'm not sure a lot of people would immediately notice or understand why.
Yeah, I mean, now you mentioned it again, I got to admit, I haven't fully fleshed this theory out. It was based on two things, really. One is that it seems like craft beer is on its way out. And I think that has to be a positive. Everyone's drinking Guinness now all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. I was in a pub on Regent Street, or near Regent Street, a few days before Christmas. And honestly, about at least 70% of people were drinking Guinness. It was just unbelievable.
It's a Gen Z thing.
Well, these words,
it's the only thing they drink.
Well, good on them, because they've grown up in a world of craft beer. And so they think that beer is rubbish, and then they discover Guinness. So
they've rejected wokeness, they've rejected craft beer.
Well, I think so. And that brings me on to my second point, the rejection of wokeness, Tom. Thank you for prompting me. It does seem like that is basically on its way. In fact, it's been quite dramatic how quickly people have been doing reverse ferret on this. And it's going to be like, I think, you know, in the 80s, everybody denied ever wearing flares. You know what I mean? It's going to be that kind of cringe element to it, I think, quite quickly. Because very, very few people ever really believed all this rubbish, did they? They went along with it because they felt intimidated. It came out of the universities, and I thought that's probably where it was going to stay. And I think it's now going to go back to the universities, and it might cling on in parts of the civil service or a couple of companies, maybe Ben and Jerry or something. But it's dying a death, particularly in America, of course, where not only have you got the Trump election, which in itself doesn't change anything, but I think it has made the corporations wake up to the fact that 77 million people voted for this guy that they thought was just unbelievably toxic. Yep. But also the Supreme Court judgment, which I don't know the full details about, but it basically, I think, said that positive discrimination, or what do they call it in America?
Affirmative action.
Affirmative action is basically racist, which it is. I mean, it's literally racist. It discriminates on the basis of people's skin color. So now, I think we just recently had McDonald's have just got rid of all their DEI stuff, Goldman Sachs and all these. I mean, basically every company in America has to get rid of most of their DEI stuff to comply with the Supreme Court. And then, because so many companies are based in America, you can just see them going, well, we might as well scrap it worldwide. And actually, now we've scrapped it, we haven't noticed any effect on productivity other than people are a bit more productive. So I just think that it's a big element of go woke, go broke to it, isn't it? You know, Disney have just, I believe, got rid of some trans character in a film. Do you know about this? I mean, Disney have been losing money hand over fist because apparently, I'm not seeing any of their films because I'm not 8 years old, but apparently 8-year-olds are not going to see them either because they're just so boring and, you know.
Well, doesn't Disney do this strange thing where they will deliberately make films, and it's not particularly strange, it's completely expedient and capitalist. They will go and film Mulan in China and orientate it completely to a Chinese audience and lean in that way. And then they'll make a film for an American audience and lean it more in that way, in the same way that you'll get BMW putting the pride flag on its cars in Europe, but not in the Middle East. I mean, like, all of these companies will act in a different way in different regions. And that's sort of where I want to challenge you on this point, Chris, which is, I mean, around half the economy in the UK is the state. The UK government is not going to be downstream of the US government when it comes to equality and inclusion and diversity.
Yeah, I'm kind of excluding Britain from my optimism in the 2020s.
This theory is fast unraveling.
I know that might seem a major exemption. But the rest of the world is rejecting leftism, basically, isn't it?
Whatever this thing was. Jacinda Ardern's gone. Nicola Sturgeon's gone. Justin Trudeau's gone. They're kind of a piece.
Macron's on his way out.
Authoritarian liberalism is sort of
the only popular leader in Europe seems to be Giorgia Meloni at the moment. It is the case that the UK is going to be just about the only country in the Western world, certainly the only significant country in the Western world, that has a centre-left government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. And that's not because the British public have gone to the left either. I mean, it's all down to this kind of lackluster Labour landslide, in which actually a very large number of people voted for right-wing parties and reform in one survey, at least, are neck and neck with... Is it
a Labour
party? 25 apiece.
25 apiece. So there is a tide, the tide of opinion is clearly turning certainly against this kind of ultra progressive woke ideology. And with it, really, I guess the parties of the centre left as well. And you've got Musk, going on and doing what he's doing, basically shaming Britain. I think it's all quite positive. Obviously, it could swing too far in the other direction, but I mean, I think there needs to be a reckoning.
Here's the worst case scenario from your perspective. In 2016, Trump won. Everyone for about 6 months checked themselves and was like, whoa, we're really out of touch. We need to go and talk to real America. It happened in the UK as well after Brexit. Yeah. Everyone sort of checked themselves. All the big news companies started going out and sort of looking beyond London, diverting resources and all the rest of it.
Like they were kind of on safari for a while.
Until the 2017 election happened and everyone suddenly decided, oh, people hate Brexit now. We can forget all of that. Like, we're going to go back to how the way things were. And actually, to some extent, going more against it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happened with Trump. As soon as he was in, you then had a blue wave in the midterms. You had a whole bunch of state elections that really went against the Republican Party. You saw actually the biggest acceleration of, if you want to call it, woke culture, under Trump as a reaction against him as a figure of authority. So are you underpricing in your theory the fact that there's the midterm elections in 2 years in the United States, where there's probably, just going by historical precedent, going to be a massive Democratic kickback? Everyone suddenly deciding Trump isn't popular anymore. Probably Elon Musk falling out with Donald Trump and some big battle over what spending to cut, and Elon saying you don't need to make all your different parts for your NASA rockets in 50 different states. You can make it all in one state, and then all the congressional lobbying that will go on for that, because the reason it's so expensive is every single different district wants its own piece of the pie. There are some really sort of political, historical, repeated facts that could blow this whole thing up. And technically, or traditionally, culture counters authority. And if the right's in authority, suddenly the culture swings the other way.
Possibly, yeah. But I'm not really making a pro-Trump or a party political point at all. I'm talking about the general climate of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the Democrat Party. Well, the Democrat Party is changing very quickly. I mean, that's another example of, like, just on a dime, people just abandoning loads of their supposedly dearly held opinions, right? Because most of the Democrats didn't believe this rubbish either.
And they were starting to do that before the election as well, hence why you had Kamala Harris constantly being confronted by various positions that she had taken on gender, on the border, and whatever, and having to say, I never said that, or trying to change the subject. So there was already this kind of sense of, there's been an element of overreach. I also do wonder if this time around, I think I'm right in saying this is the first time that Donald Trump has ever been popular, ever at the point where his positivity ratings are slightly edged above his negativity ratings, as it were. That never happened before. And again, that's not an endorsement of Trump or a suggestion that he's going to conquer all before him, but that's kind of new. And also on the other side of the culture war, if you like, there's a mood of, in America, kind of resignation. They took this result more in sadness than in anger this time around, it seemed like.
Yeah.
And that does feel like a bit of an opening to, if nothing else you say, Chris, to kind of just shove the Overton window quite, firmly in the other direction, even if nothing, it's not as if everything's gravy from here on out, but it does feel like something's changed.
No, not at all. I mean, there's loads of things Trump's going to do, probably, which I completely disagree with, and the tariffs are going to be disastrous. I'm not taking a pro right-wing party position. I'm just saying that I think this kind of fog of madness that we've been living under for quite some time now is lifting. and it will disappear very, very quickly as soon as, well, I think people are already realizing that it doesn't really have any purchase with normal people. Mm-hmm. And so much of it, let's face it, is down to uncontrolled immigration, certainly in America, but also in this country and across Europe. I think it's fair to say that is the main cause of this kind of rejection of the left. And it just seems kind of so weird to me that the center left, which could very easily just have a hegemony, really, because most people are, if you ask them what they're,
yeah,
what kind of policies they like, they're basically quite left wing in most respects, right?
As long as someone else is paying.
So yeah, sure. I mean, it's economically illiterate, a lot of it. But the fact of the matter is that center left politics are more appealing to people than any other form of politics. And the center left have thrown it all away for the sake of uncontrolled immigration and indeed illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. I don't see why illegal immigration is so important to them. They're prepared to sacrifice everything. You know what I mean?
It's the same sort of attitude that gives away the Chagos Islands. It's saying we signed up to the Refugee Convention in 1951, which says that anyone from anywhere has the right to claim asylum in the UK as long as they're on UK soil. And therefore, getting here is not technically illegal, because if you get here and then you claim asylum, you could be a legitimate refugee under the terms of the 1951 convention. And even though people, like sensible people, and I know a lot of the audience will gasp, but sensible people like Tony Blair tried to reform this and tried to, Tony Blair and Jack Straw tried to, in the early 2000s, change the 51 convention that is clearly not relevant for a 21st century world when anyone can get anywhere around the world, even on a very modest income. And strangely, that got nowhere, even though I'd say that just about every Western European country would think that this should be reformed. There needs to be a big moment of reckoning with this treaty that is, you know, more than half a century old. And yet, for many on the left, that is venerated as far more superior than a sovereign parliament or domestic interests, in the same way that if the UN votes, even with a minority of states participating in that vote, that the Chagos Islands should belong to Mauritius, partly because most European countries abstained on that vote because they were angry about Brexit, then we get to a position where we're going to be one of the few countries that venerates international agreements and UN decisions. And the most powerful countries in the world, by military might or economic might, China and indeed the United States of America, are going to be disregarding those same advisory decisions. It's a very peculiar sort of fork in the road, and we're probably taking the wrong fork.
And Starmer definitely does feel like the slowest kid in the class on this issue, as well as many others, not least because there's also a lot of European countries who are very quickly, even under more supposedly centrist government, starting to think, you know what, the current settlement on asylum is ridiculous. I mean,
Denmark in particular.
Denmark, which
I think is still one of the few countries that does have
Social Democratic Party, because it's gone in this
much more. They've gone zero immigration.
They were massively ahead of the curve in Denmark. I mean, we're talking 5 years ago. Yeah. The Social Democrats were the ones talking about migration when Angela Merkel was still in charge of Germany and with wide open borders. Denmark was like absolutely not here. But Denmark also is one of the few European countries that hasn't been in recession over the last year, mainly because of Novo Nordisk and Ozempic, which is a Danish company.
Reason to be optimistic.
Kept the Danish out of recession. If it weren't for that one company, they'd have been in recession too.
That's an incredible fact. And I do think, though, in terms of where this commitment to all of these obviously ridiculous policies comes from, like this idea that you would point to a case like the acid attacker in South London and people just start looking into the distance and talk vaguely about Winston Churchill and the Refugee Convention. Like, obviously this was not created with this gentleman, this acid attacker in mind, and yet nevertheless they can't think about it. Is that they just don't really think very deeply about a lot of this stuff.
I think it's more straightforward than that. They just would do anything to be not accused of being racist. That's what it comes down to. And if you go back to 2015, when Ed Miliband had a very mild pledge to, I can't remember what the exact words were, but it was something like, get control of immigration.
Yeah, controls on immigration.
Controls on immigration.
I have the mug.
And some people on the left were going crazy about the idea that you would control immigration. And wanting to control any form of immigration was considered racist to these people. Mm-hmm. Now, 10 years later, even wanting to control illegal immigration is considered racist. Except, of course, for most people, it's a completely reasonable thing to do. And this, as I say, is why the left, quite needlessly, I think, have just lost power in so many places because of this determination to pursue an immigration policy that most people consider to be insane and indeed is literally illegal.
Yeah, and that they only embraced very recently as well, as you point out with the Ed Miliband example.
One of the reasons why Trump had such a big swing in New York, as far as I'm aware, is because of the policy of Greg Abbott, the Texas governor,
legend,
who bussed migrants, illegal migrants, of which tens of millions or more than 10 million have crossed across the southern border in the United States in the last four-year period, were bussed up to, you know, sanctuary cities, Democrat areas, and people saw the results of that. I mean, a lot of these people were not socialized in the same way that you might expect Western European country natives to be socialized. And people saw a lot of that vagrancy and crime and some of the nastier elements that came along with it. I think that's a huge, huge reason why there was this swing towards Donald Trump in places like New York.
No, absolutely. And while we're on the subject of the vibe shift, should we also talk a bit about Mark Zuckerberg? He made waves this week by making an announcement that his company Meta and the big platforms that it owns, Instagram, Facebook, Threads, although it doesn't really qualify as a big platform, I'm not sure, were going to...
Blue Sky. Yeah. Why
don't you know, please? Doesn't
yeah, Threads was like a kind of, was Blue Sky before Blue Sky, wasn't it? Before and after Mastodon or whatever. They all fold in the end. But he was announcing that essentially he was going to do a Musk in relation to his speech policies. He was going to get rid of the fact checkers and replace them with community notes. He was going to move his trust and safety team, the people who draw up the content policies, from California to Texas to try and assuage conservative concerns about bias. And even said he was looking forward to partnering with the Trump administration. We should say he's also donated to the fund for the inauguration in order to push back against the attempts from hostile foreign governments to try and limit speech to influence the policies of American big tech firms. This is a huge shift, Tom, but what did you make of it? I mean, do you think this is a sincere move, or do you think this is him just recognizing what way the wind is blowing in the way that we've been talking about?
I think Mark Zuckerberg is a very different guy to Elon Musk. In some ways, he's entirely consistent. I mean, he's always been a sort of small state, libertarian, tech bro kind of guy, but he's more expedient and makes friends more easily than someone like Elon Musk. When the Democrats were in charge and the threats of regulation were very much coming from the left, he cozied up to the left, and he did the bidding of the White House in many ways during the COVID pandemic. I mean, situation is clear that when the White House said this sort of thing should not be allowed on Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg said, okay, absolutely. But I think that that came from not a position of I'm on board with you ideologically. That came from a position of please don't shut us down, pass European-style regulation against us, destroy our business model any more than sort of you're threatening to do already. But now the regulatory threat has shifted significantly. I mean, we still don't know whether or not TikTok will be banned in the United States, predominantly from a sort of conservative push to ban it. And I think if you're a sort of small state libertarian, like I think Mark Zuckerberg is intrinsically, your concern has now shifted to the people who run the country, which is the right. So it makes complete sense to sack Nick Clegg. It makes complete sense to shift to, you know, the former chief of staff for George W. Bush, who now has Clegg's job. But it also made complete sense to hire Nick Clegg 7 years ago when the regulatory threats were from Europe. Because he's the guy that was an MEP, knows everyone in Brussels, former deputy PM, but he's also an intrinsically liberal guy in some ways. Clegg was the perfect messenger if you're trying to get across to Europe. I think the biggest unreported shift that's gone on here inside Meta, inside Facebook, is that they just don't care about Europe anymore. Europe is a poorer market, relatively, than it was 10 years ago. Europe is sort of, they've sort of given up hope that Europe is ever going to be liberal when it comes to regulation, particularly towards AI, which is the other thing that Meta does in a huge, huge way. Just as a little tangent, Meta invested loads in GPUs because they were doing this weird metaverse VR thing. Turns out all of that investment that Mark Zuckerberg did for the weird headset stuff is really useful for AI, because all of these data centers that he made for all of this compute power that he invested in for his metaverse, he's now switching over to use for Meta AI. So he just got really lucky there. Mm-hmm. But the latest Meta Llama AI system, not available in Europe, just as the latest Sora OpenAI system, not available in Europe. It's available in Pakistan. It's available in Afghanistan. It's available in South Saharan Africa. It's not available in Europe.
When you say Europe, do you mean the EU?
I mean the European Economic Area, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. So anywhere that is daft enough to maintain European regulations, mm-hmm. particularly GDPR. So I think it's not just the vibe shift of Donald Trump coming in that has made this Meta sort of policy shift. It's also the fact that Europe as a continent is just less and less relevant. It's poorer and it is growing very, very slowly, if at all. And I think a lot of these big tech companies think, why do we need to bother? Yeah. All Europe does is tax us and regulate us. I mean, the number of balmy lawsuits that the European Commission has put against Apple and Google and Facebook and all the rest of them, forcing iPhones to change their ports, saying that Google can't have Google search as the default on Android devices. All of this anti sort of business position that you get from the Commission. I mean, these big tech companies on which we all rely are just going to see us as a sort of backwater that doesn't need to be dealt with. And it won't be the tech companies that suffer because of that.
And there was even a little sly dig to Europe in his announcement where he said, because of the environment there, how it's become impossible, as he said, to build anything over there. So certainly some truth to that. Chris, what do you make of Zuckerberg's announcement?
Well, that's another example of what we were talking about before. You know, things are changing. And you can say, well, this is a cynical move to curry favor with Trump, and I'm sure that's true. But it does show that people like Zuckerberg's support for this kind of thing is pretty shallow.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would never really sincere in the first place. So he's ditching it. Great. I mean, the fact-checking thing is interesting because I actually like most of the fact-checking websites and I think they're useful and I like, you know, the truth. And it's interesting that a lot of people who go around talking a lot of bullshit were really celebrating the fact that the fact-checkers are no longer going to be employed by Facebook. But on the other hand, I've had a run-in with Logically, the company one of the companies that Facebook used for an article I wrote for you guys, which you headlined. What was the headline, Tom?
I think it was Smoke Fags Save Lives. Yeah.
That probably didn't help things.
I was very proud of that.
But this was about what is now actually known in the scientific literature as the smoker's paradox. And it's basically accepted as facts, I think, which is that smokers, for whatever reason, were less likely to contract COVID-19, and I wrote about this for Spike because I thought it was hilarious, basically. And then it got some sort of warning on Facebook, and there was a fact check, which was really just piss poor because it didn't really challenge what I was saying. It just quoted a few anti-smoking people who were going, oh, we don't believe this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really a fact check, is it?
Yeah. Just to dive into that question, is it less likely to contract it in the first place, or is it the death rate? Because I can give you a reason why smokers might be less likely to die from COVID-19.
What's that?
Old and vulnerable respiratory issues. Smokers have already died.
Mm. Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was
like a prophylactic.
It was who got it in the first place,
right?
It was about who tested positive. We know this because they then, they did quite a few large ecological surveys. Every now and again, they would just test everybody in a town or something. And they would come back and it was like the smokers are like half as likely to have it than anyone else. There was a paper a few months ago that suggested that it might be because smokers apparently get colds more often and this might have given them some immunity to COVID. I don't know. I'm in no position to comment. But the point is, nor was bloody Logically or Facebook.
Yeah.
And so that was a standard fact-checking and good riddance. I've got to mention Armando Iannucci.
Yeah.
You see his tweet about this? So, I mean, I'm sure people know who...
But he is a comic genius who was behind some of the best television shows and most prophetic TV shows, not just The Thick of It over this side of the pond, but Veep, which when Kamala Harris was selected to be Democratic nominee for president, suddenly started doing the rounds again because of how, just like Selena Meyer, the titular character of Veep, was to Kamala Harris. I mean, they're the same person, this sort of accidental vice president who accidentally could be president. I mean, the clips were, I think, hugely damning for Kamala.
No, absolutely. It's funny how someone of such tremendous comedic and political satire gifts can have such pedestrian, idiotic political
and have
opinions,
his brain but, broken by the discourse so easily.
Yeah, you know? And he feels about 5 years behind as well. Yeah. But anyway, Chris, you were going to read something out.
Well, his latest hysterical tweet involves Facebook no longer employing fact checkers, and he says, "And so we move into the next phase of reality's Squid Game, the end of fact-checking. From now on, what happened, what you think happened, what you wanted to have happened, and what other people said happened are all of equal value. Other than people getting killed, what could possibly go wrong?" Right, Armando, firstly, they're not banning fact-checkers, right? Facebook are just not paying for them anymore. They can still be around. Mm-hmm. I know it's a full
I'm sure they could have a Facebook page.
Full Facts, actually, which is, I do have a lot of time for Full Facts. Mm. But they put out a slightly hysterical tweet. I guess they're on this bandwagon now.
Yeah.
And their chief exec said fact checkers are being locked out of the conversation. Well, fact check, they're not. You know, claim untrue. They're not being locked out of the conversation. Yeah. They're just not being paid by Facebook to do this. Mm. There's some bloody, they've actually got a union. They've got some sort of trade union or trade association to fact checkers now, the European fact checking. I can't remember what it's called. But they put out a very indignant tweet. Saying we can't believe we've been, you know, let down by this. You know, I
look forward to them all downing tools and no one. Yeah,
go on, fact checkers are going on strike. You know, I remember going to the Battle Ideas quite a few years ago, and I saw the guy from Full Facts in the fairly early days, and I was quite impressed by him and his organisation. Still am, really, but they were made it very clear that they were a charity. Mm-hmm. They're voluntarily, you know, funded by voluntary donations. Clearly, along the way, these groups have just managed to get in with big corporations and maybe even the governments. I don't know. And it's turned into a bit of a racket, as far as I can see. Look, if you want to give money to Full Facts, don't blame you. Yeah, I'm tempted to give money to them myself. Not actually going to do it, but I wouldn't be against doing it. Yeah? But you know, why can't they just survive as being independent organizations? Yeah. Why do they need bloody Meta to be given millions of pounds? So, yeah, look. Armando Iannucci is just wetting the bed, as he has done ever since Brexit, to be fair. It really isn't the end of the world. Even if the fact checkers were banned, and that's not happening, it still wouldn't be 1984.
But it is worth saying as well that like fact checking was, in many instances, have become quite a kind of corrupted business. You know, there is Full Fact. There are some good people out there who do try to look at the issues and try to... Yeah. Present a clear
and then
assessment.
There's BBC
of the
Verify.
Oh. BBC or the BBC Fact Check, which
or
was
the Channel 4 Fact Checks.
No, Forerunner.
The hilarious thing about BBC Verify is that it implies the rest of the BBC's content is not verified.
Yeah, right. They're just going by the seat of the
like
pants.
Fact checking should be a basic journalistic skill.
Okay, this is the bit of the website you should believe. The rest of it, I can't really say. But some of these organisations are very good and they do try. To, you know, fact check one side, fact check the other side, good stuff. I mean, a useful contribution to debate. But it is an intrinsically political decision what you fact check.
Exactly, yeah.
And I mean, and a good example of this is Donald Trump, who clearly a lot of people had a derangement syndrome about. Mm-hmm. Many people for good reason. I mean, the guy has regularly lied. But so do lots of politicians.
Yeah.
And I think it's another problem with Boris Johnson as well. When a journalist or a fact checker gets it into their head that this particular politician is a liar, you're then looking out for things that you wouldn't count as lies if another politician said them.
Yeah.
And so you get these listicles of, you know, 100 times Donald Trump lied in this debate. And some of them are like, he gets the year wrong by like a year.
Right, yeah.
or it's these sort of
or accuses
that,
Ted Cruz's dad of being a serial killer. Everyone knows that's the
right, right.
That's not.
But no, you
or just subjective opinions,
right?
Or hyperbole, or whatever it is. You know,
or a joke. Yeah.
and it gets to the point where actually you're now providing ammunition for the supporters of Donald Trump, and it's like you're saying this, but actually he's you know telling the truth, or you know what do you mean he lied? That's not a lie. That's and it all builds into this very peculiar narrative that actually. A post on Facebook that has a little fact check underneath. Well, the choice to fact check that, but not fact check that, the other thing, that's a political choice. And then you're sort of almost choosing to disregard this bit of content, but not that bit of content. Now, there are lots of bits of content where that's a really easy decision. It's the edge cases where that really, really matters.
And where things are unclear. You know, the lab leak is a good example of this. Yeah. No one really knew what was going on early days, but it's like, we've been told by... the American security services and a few doctors that this is obviously nonsense, so therefore we're just going to ban it outright. And also to your point, Tom, I thought it was funny when, I think it was after Biden's inauguration speech, it was either the Washington Post or one of the big liberal newspapers in America, one of their big correspondents said it's refreshing to have a presidential speech I don't have to fact check, considering Biden's sloppiness, shall we say, for all kinds of reasons, with not knowing, you know, whether it was Volodymyr Zelensky or Vladimir Putin, etc. Maybe he grew to regret that tweet. But Chris, we're fast running out of time. I know you want to talk about an incredible story, which has emerged from the Netherlands. It speaks to the misinformation, the genuine misinformation around vaping. And this is one Dutch mother's story and her struggle with her son who's vaping. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, this Dutch woman has discovered a cure for vaping. And that cure is Marlboro Lights. So this is highly reminiscent of something I can't remember if you mentioned on the pod, but I wrote about it a while ago. There was an Australian doctor whose son started vaping and he got him off the vapes by buying him a pack of cigarettes, which is exactly what this woman did in the Netherlands. He started vaping at the age of about 13 or 14. Her and her dopey husband tried to work out what the equivalent number of cigarettes were in his vape, which you can't actually do.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, people don't absorb all the nicotine in a cigarette or in a vape, but they absorb a lot less of the nicotine in the vape than they do in a cigarette. So just looking at the milligrams of nicotine on a pack of cigarettes and the milligrams on a vape, it doesn't tell you anything at all. This lad apparently got hold of a 12,000 puff vape, which is, that's a lot. If you don't know what that means, like an average disposable would be 600. Right. So firstly, this vape was totally illegal because the reason a disposable vape has 600 in it is because that is the EU limit. So he was getting hold of an illegal vapes at the age of 13. They were flavored, which flavors are actually banned in the Netherlands, e-cigarette flavors. And so are nicotine pouches. The Netherlands have gone really crazy on the nanny state in recent years. So he was using very illegal vapes underage. Mm-hmm. It's obviously illegal to sell vapes to under 18s as well in Netherlands. And she was saying basically they should be banned because apparently that ban would work.
Yeah, unlike where all the other ones didn't.
but because politicians have neglected to ban vapes, she's had to take matters into her own hands by buying her son endless packets of cigarettes. And this very long article, which it's only in Dutch, but if people want to read more, and they should, go on my Substack where there's a translate of most of it on there. It's quite extraordinary on multiple layers, this story, because the amount of misinformation this woman has absorbed is quite incredible. But the ultimate outcome, and particularly the final few paragraphs, amazing. It ends basically with her son and a friend, who has also quit vapes by smoking, sitting on a beach smoking. And she's saying how happy she is. And that, yes, they are still smoking, but they'll give that up at some point in the future.
That's amazing.
Don't need to worry. The main thing is he's no longer on the elf bars.
I'm on this woman's side. I'm often, you know.
Yeah?
Just the fact that young people are not smoking and vaping instead.
Right.
It's a sign of
decline. You want that to be a gateway.
Yeah.
Because she's actually created the gateway. One of the great fears about vaping is, oh, the gateway effect. Gateway effect just doesn't exist, right? There's no reason why people go from vaping to smoking. Mm-hmm. The only time it's ever existed is when, like, Australian doctors and stupid Dutch mothers buy their kids cigarettes to
and
get them off.
And her kids' friends as well, which is a great twist. That, Tom, what did you make of all this?
When you first said this, I thought, is she sort of trying to make a political point? is this performance art? Is this a protest? Mm. Like, I'm going to ruin my son's lungs until he's banned vaping, some sort of threat against a government?
It would make more sense if that was.
But no, the woman's just thick. I mean, there's nothing else that explains this. This is just a very dim, low IQ woman who cannot ingest any of the. I mean, how can.
There's also, to be fair, being misinformed by multiple people because she does quote.
No, that's not to be fair. Just because someone tells you a lie doesn't mean you have to believe
published
it.
Published in a newspaper as well.
Like, it is symptomatic of the climate disease of misinformation in places like the Netherlands, because she's quoting these doctors who are, if anything, even more badly informed than.
They should lose their licenses.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. But they should lose their licenses and she should lose her children.
And the
kind of liberal stuff we like on this.
The gist of what the doctors were saying was basically better the devil you know. You know, we know a lot about how bad cigarettes are for you. We don't know what the long-term effects of vaping are.
We know about the tar. We don't know about those funky lights on his...
Yeah, well, I mean, by that sort of, you know, logic, you shouldn't have a COVID vaccine. I mean, if you're going to take that to its logical extension, which, by the way, is wrong...
If you don't have 70-year
data of like a new thing, you can't have that thing. I mean, we wouldn't have like most food.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more to be said on this other than this is a woman who probably needs to be institutionalized. or I don't know, needs a bit more omega-3. which actually is probably another one of these fake facts that it does nothing to improve IQ.
But I didn't know that was even the claim.
I think
eating fish makes you clever.
We'll get that. That's the sort of claim.
It probably is.
Lots of middle class kids are given sort of omega-3 tablets in the hope that they'll grow up to be super smart. And it's all nonsense, as far as I'm aware.
If that's any cigarettes. Exactly. Smoke fags save lives, improve lives. Shall we reach into the postbag, Chris?
Yes, please.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So this is where we ask our listeners to send in questions for Chris and our guests. Let's kick off with something topical. Your thoughts, Tom, on Rachel from Accounts versus Liz Truss. Obviously, we're in a situation now where government borrowing is actually more expensive now than it was under Liz Truss. Rachel Reeves is making a horrible go of it. What do you make of all of this? Has Liz Truss rather been vindicated, as she has been saying in recent days?
I think it's really, really clear that if pension funds were still structured how they were in October 2022, we would see exactly the same effect that we saw in the days following the so-called mini budget right now that we saw then. I mean, exactly the same thing would happen. What happened was all of these LDIs that were sort of peculiarly structured to, as far as I'm aware, get around some regulations for the pension funds to own government debt. If the price of government debt ticked up even a little bit, this whole house of cards was just ready to collapse. It would have required Bank of England intervention. I mean, the pound would have plummeted, all the rest of it. It just so happened that Liz Truss was there when this, you know, canister of petrol was lit, rather than Rachel Reeves. I mean, if Liz Truss had never happened and we never borrowed a penny more than previously, and then Rachel Reeves got in, I mean, we would have the same meltdown, and the Labour Party would be not just at 25% in the polls, they'd be at 5%. But I mean, this is sort of the concerning thing, because I don't want to completely exonerate Liz Truss here. I mean, her budget massively increased the deficit. Like, everyone says that Liz Truss was this super radical libertarian, Javier Milei style prime minister. She wasn't. I mean, the main bit of deficit ballooning in that mini budget was actually something previously announced, the energy price guarantee. You know, fixing energy prices, what could have been between £100 billion and £200 billion of extra spending. I mean, that was the massive destabilizing thing. So we shouldn't say Liz Truss did nothing wrong, because that was the number one biggest bit of spending that the government had done since furlough, which the government seemed to do out of political pressure from Keir Starmer, back when Keir Starmer was either unknown or deeply unpopular, before he had his brief time in the sunshine as a politician. So, I mean, that was bad, but also the fact that Rachel Reeves' budget, everyone talks about the tax rises. And tax rises, clearly bad for productivity, bad for employment, sure. But they're dwarfed by the borrowing.
Yeah.
The borrowing, the extra borrowing and the rule change in the budget. I mean, it was £24 billion in the first year, rising to over £40 billion by the fourth or fifth year of the forecast. All in all, £145 billion of borrowing over the course of the parliament. I mean, that's just enormous. The idea that you could get away with this by a rule change on how we measure our assets versus liabilities is clearly nonsense. I mean, it's clearly had an effect, and the UK's behaving worse than other comparable countries.
And the really important thing is, how much are we paying for that debt, right? And this is what the bond yields really. Mm. Yeah, it's very easy to try and own Rachel Rees by going like, oh, you said that Liz Truss crashed the economy when bond yields were like this, and now they're even higher. And it's a perfectly valid point to make because it was always a lie that Liz Truss crashed the economy. Mm. The mini budget wasn't the most sensible thing in the world by any means because it was an inflationary measure at a time of high inflation.
Also, even if you leave effort to kind of prepare the ground for it.
It was pretty disastrous, but it didn't crash the economy. And I do have some sympathy when she says I didn't know about this LDI thing. But all the same, it was an inflationary measure at a time of double-digit inflation, which was pretty stupid. But I think the debt and the deficit, no one wants to really talk about it anymore. Because I guess we talked about it for so long under David Cameron, and people maybe even think that somehow he sorted it out. Of course, he didn't. Things got dramatically worse under Theresa May and then under Boris Johnson with COVID and then with every prime minister since. We're looking at what we're talking, £100 billion a year borrowing on average from now on, the rest of the parliament. So something in that region. Yeah. And 2 or 3 years ago, and for most of the 2010s, you would have the likes of Jonathan Porter saying, well, you can't afford not to borrow at these interest rates and if it's for investment. And there is an element of truth to that. If you are genuinely investing to build roads or something useful, bridges or something, yeah, fine, borrow at very low interest rates. Those people have gone very quiet now. I haven't noticed any of these people going like, oh, well, now that we're paying 5% on this, obviously we should have austerity, we should stop borrowing so much, or indeed put taxes up or something. But they don't, because these people just believe in just borrowing endless amounts of money all the time. The reason that the markets are worried at the moment is because under Rachel Reeves and under Jeremy Hunt before her, the policy effectively was let's borrow the absolute maximum that we can all the time, regardless of whether the economy is growing or shrinking or somewhere in between. That's the policy. We just keep on maxing out the credit card, but we don't do it to the extent that you then result in a mini budget style crashing of the economy, so-called. Now, that to me is not the way to run the economy. Mm. You know, I'm a fiscal conservative, which is why I was pretty skeptical about the mini budget in the first place. But you don't need to be a huge fiscal conservative to realize that borrowing the absolute maximum you can is a foolish policy, because apart from anything else, it means that if things just go in the wrong direction, and if the OBR is not correct, and bearing in mind the OBR is predicting 2% GDP growth this year, which is bonkers, suddenly you run out of so-called fiscal headroom, and the markets do react.
Yeah, and then you're going to have some pretty nasty consequences. I mean, it could be that the Labour Party is the first party that actually has to do some austerity in ever since 2015 when we last had austerity.
They'll put taxes on.
Well, that's still austerity. But I think the mad thing is that politicians always measure investment by amount spent. And it's like, how many billions did you spend on infrastructure projects versus how many billions did you spend on infrastructure projects? I don't care. How many things did you build? I mean, if you're building one nuclear power station that is 6 times more expensive than a South Korean nuclear power station, that doesn't mean that you're investing more. You're getting the same thing. You're just paying 6 times more for it. Mm-hmm. If you're paying £100 billion for a railway, I mean, that doesn't mean that, hooray, you've invested £100 billion. You could have built that railway for £20 billion. You could have probably built it for 10 if you used the sort of Spanish or French.
Your beloved Crossrail is a good example of this, isn't it?
Yeah.
Horrendously over budget. And everyone's kind of forgotten about it now because they don't call it Crossrail. They call it Elizabeth Line. Everyone goes, it's beautiful.
That's a wonderful rebranding.
Branding genius. We're happy now that it's here. And we just wish there would be more of them.
I just wish the stations won fewer architecture awards. I mean, they could have had plainer stations, saved, tens of millions of pounds. Sure, they wouldn't have. I think they've won 3 different awards for the design of the stations. This seems like a lovely optional extra that we could have if we hadn't, had a shrinking economy for the last 3 months in a row.
You can't put a price on beauty.
No, exactly. Building beautiful. As many people on the right politics have been obsessed with.
The thing is, I don't think they're that beautiful. Architects think they're beautiful.
That's the other thing about it, is because it's just that kind of weird kind of yellowy ivory coating. Everything's quite cavernous.
I can see how someone who's done 7 years in university to become an architect has been trained to like this stuff. I would prefer just sort of, some arches and some stone.
Yeah.
And knock down Euston Station and rebuild the Euston Arch.
So what is it you like so much about the Elizabeth Line?
We started off by you saying how great it is.
It is a brilliant light.
Is it just because it's fast?
It's spacious.
Chris,
don't get me wrong. I mean, like, the amount of design that has gone into this thing, fluid dynamics have dictated the sort of the bend of the tunnels to allow the most sort of smooth flow of people as if they were a liquid going through the station. Mm-hmm. Like, all of this nonsense, which is actually, like, great. It's a fantastic piece of infrastructure. But I would have settled for a good piece of infrastructure that was half the price rather than a fantastic piece of infrastructure that was, you know, 10 times the price.
Absolutely. And we are fast running out of time before we get into questions of infrastructure and how fluid
it is. 20 minutes ago.
No, exactly. So we've only got one. this is what I'm up against. But if you get Tom on the subject of the Elizabeth line, this is always what is going to happen. But before we let you go, Tom, we wanted to ask you our final question, as we ask all of our guests, because this is a very libertarian anti-ban podcast. Mm. If you had to have one ban, what would it be?
I've been thinking about this a lot, and I went through a number of different sort of little tidbits, but I think I've settled on something because I experienced this yesterday. I was in a Sainsbury's and a couple of kids ran in, grabbed a bunch of stuff off the shelf and ran out. And because it's below £200, no one does anything about that, right? That's sort of legal shoplifting. So I would ban shoplifting. I know it's a controversial policy. I know that police forces up and down the country think that this is, you know, beyond the realms of possibility. But I think I'd ban stealing things.
Never work in London.
No. How are you going to enforce it?
Stop me if this is a radical idea. Yeah. But what if we used some taxes to pay for sort of patrol officers?
Oh yeah,
we could give them little helmets. They could perhaps carry truncheons.
Sounded
to keep
a bit
order.
Fascist to me.
Interesting. Oh yeah, maybe.
Go around maybe arresting people.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then have some sort of judicial system.
Okay, where people could sort of answer for the crimes they did.
Yeah.
Why don't we do that?
And if we find, maybe we get, I don't know, 10, 12 people to decide whether they're guilty.
Yeah.
And if they say yes, then put them in some sort of building where they can't get out.
Oh, like you could lock the door.
Use a key.
And then they couldn't steal things because they'd be locked in the building.
Yeah, they'd
building.
Be sort of punished, as it were.
Wow. Why hasn't anyone thought about this before?
This is the kind of blue sky thinking you get on this podcast.
What you get from-
but on that inspirational note, Tom, Chris, thank you both very much.
Thank you. Good night.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.